Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. To whom was God speaking in Genesis 1:26 when he said, "Let us make humanity in our image"? My guest today, Sam Mansfield of Adelaide, South Australia, has found six different answers to this question. In the following interview, I ask him about his recent presentation at the inaugural Australian Unitarian Christian Alliance conference called Wrought with Wisdom, How Solomon Understood Genesis 1:26, 3:22, and 11:7. Mansfield puts forward the deliberative position with a twist. Here now is episode 655, God Spoke to Himself in Genesis 1:26 with Sam Mansfield. Today with me is Sam Mansfield of Adelaide in Australia. Welcome, Sam. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on the podcast. It's nice to be on an episode of a podcast that I frequently listen to.
Awesome. Well, I thought to start out, you could share a little bit about your background and your upbringing and your journey of faith. So where would you like to start for that?
Well, it all started when I was born. No. I was born in Sydney, and I was brought up in the Christadelphian faith, which is a biblical Unitarian faith that also has a strong emphasis on the promises in the Old Testament and how they're realized in the man Jesus, including the promise of a kingdom on earth. So those were the types of teachings that I was brought up in. I attended two different Christadelphian churches or ecclesias in Sydney, and then just before the global pandemic started, I moved down to Adelaide to be closer to my girlfriend, who is now my wife. So we got married in 2021, and I've been living in the faith since I was born, but I chose to take it on for myself when I was baptized in 2016. So I committed my life to Christ and doing my best to serve him and to serve his God. So I'm frequently involved in a Christadelphian church here in Adelaide in giving sermons, because Christadelphians are a lay community. Yeah, I frequently give sermons. My wife and I teach Sunday school. We teach sort of Bible basics to them. That's the kind of lessons we're doing at the moment. And they're around 17, 18-year-olds, and they're, okay, they're really switched on. So it gives us a lot to think about and talk about. That's sort of the general gist about me.
And tell us about your secular life. You have a degree and a career, right? What do you do for a living?
I got a degree while I was living in Sydney in audio, which is why I've got all of my equipment here and a little bit of audio conditioning to deaden the sound. And also, I really enjoy music, as you can probably see from the mandolin on my wall. It took me 2 years to do my audio degree, and then I kind of discovered that I couldn't really use it for anything unless I knew somebody really well in the industry who could get me a job. So I ended up working for a company in Adelaide that was owned at the time by Christadelphians. Became really good friends with them, and then their company was recently purchased, and I went across to the new company doing the same thing. My job is a little bit strange. For the most part, look after the live streaming of funerals. So I have the really unique position of constantly being at different people's services.
Wow.
They could be atheists, they could be Buddhists, but I'm quite frequently in a lot of Catholic and Orthodox churches, and Lutherans as well, occasionally a Baptist one. I've even been to a Unitarian Universalist meeting hall, which was an interesting experience. So, yeah, I get around.
That's fascinating. So tell us about your name a little bit and the Mansfield lore of Australia within Christadelphian circles. I didn't tell you this, but I actually was told about Mansfields in general by Leah Anderson when she was talking with me about our event that happened a couple months ago, and she's like, "Oh yeah, Sam Mansfield. Yeah, he's from the Mansfield." And I'm like, "I don't know what that means." So maybe you could just share a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Mansfields are both a big and popular, maybe for good reasons, maybe for bad reasons, a big and popular family within the Christadelphian community. The Mansfield name is kind of a staple. For good reasons, because a lot of people would be familiar with a range of different written works called the Expositor Series, which are a number of green books. They're written by a H.P. Mansfield, which would be my great uncle. And the Mansfield name has been in the Christadelphian community, at least here in Australia, for a few generations. So people kind of get familiar with the name.
Okay.
So if we ever get in trouble, people sort of pick up on it pretty quickly and they'll remember that. But hopefully I stand alone as an individual with the name Sam Mansfield, and people can judge me on my merits and my demerits, and hopefully there's not too many of those.
Okay, very good. And as far as the UCA goes, when did you first hear about the UCA? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. It was probably about 3 years ago, and I was sort of getting into debates here and there with people online over questions of the Trinity and the Incarnation. And I was getting pressed by Catholic apologists saying, you know, oh, you're coming in the 21st century and saying that you've got the correct Bible teaching when we've been looking after the correct Bible teaching since the time of Peter. And I thought, that's a really interesting claim. I need to go research and see if that's actually the case, because like you, I'm a truth seeker. I love the slogan at the end of Restitutio, the truth has nothing to fear.
There it is.
So I thought, if I go digging, then I should be able to find the truth, and either I'll be happy that I've reaffirmed that what I already understood was true, or I'll discover what is actually true, and I'll be happy that I discovered something new that was the truth. And I ended up bumping into the Trinity's podcast by our friend Dale Tuggy.
Okay.
And I binge listened to all of his episodes, and then I struck gold.
That's a lot of episodes.
Yeah. I remember chatting to him when I met him in Sydney. Well, I met him in Melbourne, but I chatted to him after there was a Thursday night presentation that he did, a presentation with Stephen Dodson. Mm-hmm. And I met Stephen Dodson for the first time as well. And I mentioned to Dale quite sheepishly that in some of his more philosophically based episodes, my eyes kind of glazed over a little bit.
And he
was totally fine with it. But I sat through every single minute. So yeah, and then I hit the episode, which was about the first sort of board meeting of the UCA. And I thought, this is interesting. Let's check this out. And I thought, well, as a Christadelphian, I read the charter, and I thought, this is actually something I can get behind, because it's only about this one single issue of believing that the one God is the Father and that Jesus is his son, the Messiah. And I thought, that's what I believe. So let's see how I can support and chat to people and encourage them who have accepted this truth and go from there.
And why did you decide to submit a paper for the event? Was it in March? I think it was just a couple of months ago.
Yes, it was. Yeah, in March. I saw that a lot of the presentations going up on YouTube were pretty high quality. And I was thinking to myself, is it possible that I could write a paper? Maybe I could at least give it a go, but I wouldn't even have thought of where to start. Myself and a lot of people in my community, the Christadelphians, are truth seekers, students of the Bible. We love the Bible and we believe that it's God's word. So we're always seeking to try and understand different things about it, different passages, different books. And I'd been thinking a lot about the use of plural pronouns by God in Genesis.
Okay.
There's three instances of it, which is Genesis 1:26, 3:22, and 11:6. But the one of greatest interest is probably the first one, because that's about the creation of humanity. And it's one of these really rare times that God speaks with plural pronouns when he says, let us create man in our image. Mm-hmm. And for the longest time, ever since I was sort of brought up in Sunday school, I was taught that that was the angels. And so I just accepted that. That's actually how God typically works throughout the rest of scriptures. So the pattern you would expect kind of fit. But what was missing was basically any evidence that the angels were involved in creation. And whenever you bump into later passages in the Bible, like in Job and Isaiah, God just takes credit for it himself. He doesn't say that anybody else helped him. He said, I did this alone. I did this by myself. You don't see that for other major miracles that God works in the Bible, like the parting of the Red Sea. God doesn't say, I parted it by myself, or I led the children of Israel out of Egypt by myself, because he used an agent, Moses, to do that. So whenever I tried other test cases to see if maybe when God says alone and by myself, maybe that was him referring to him doing that by his own power, his sole power, it didn't seem to work. So I was looking for answers to what's the correct way to try and interpret these plural pronouns.
Okay, so the paper is called Wrought with Wisdom, How Solomon Understood Genesis 1:26, 3:22, and 11:7. And it's 27 pages long, 133 footnotes, extensive bibliography.
Exactly 6,000 words.
One, two, three page bibliography. What'd you say, 6,000 words?
Exactly.
Okay. Yes, if you are interested in this, I don't know how people could get a hold of it, but maybe they can email you or something, Sam.
Yeah, so they can contact me at, I've got a podcast that I've just started up, which is the In His Truth podcast, the one that would be most accessible to basically any Christian would be the one on YouTube, which is the extended one, where you get to see my beautiful face. Not very beautiful, but at least it gives you something to look at. I give you plenty of slides, so you don't have to look at my face all the time. But you can contact me at inhistruthpodcast@gmail.com.
Okay.
And I also hope, God willing, within the next few weeks to tidy up the bibliography a little bit more and pop that up on academia.edu. So
awesome.
I'll probably leave a comment on the YouTube presentation version that the UCA has put up.
Yes, and the presentation is available on the UCA YouTube channel, and it's been up for, I don't know, a few weeks at least. I was thinking we could work through, obviously not all the details of your paper, but at least starting with the text itself. And, you know, I know you've already mentioned it, but I'm just going to bring it up here. It says, then God said, let us make humans in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. And then in verse 27, so God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them, and male and female, he created them. So one of the things you talk about in the paper is how we have this plural here, let us, and then we also have it here, our image, right? Our likeness. And then down here in the next verse, it just says his image. And I suppose verse 26 is what God said. This is God's speech here. And then in verse 27, this is what God did. He created in his image. And, you know, one of the points that you kind of draw about all this is that we have a difference here. We have the plural, and then we have the singular. And so you have all these different theories that you go through in the paper, the plural of majesty, the plural of fullness, the plural of deliberation, mythological address, earthly address, heavenly address. So you have six different positions that you work through. So I was thinking you could start our time here of looking at this verse by just briefly telling us, like, okay, well, what are each of these options? So could you tell us what the plural of majesty is?
Yeah, so the plural of majesty is where a particular, it's often used of nouns in Hebrew and also other ancient languages, where the referent is actually singular, but more majesty or intensity or honor is attributed to that singular referent by making the word a grammatical plural.
Okay.
Dustin Smith actually does a really excellent UCA presentation on this, which I would highly recommend. Where I very meekly would depart from Dustin, however, is Dustin says that that applies to other forms, including pronominal suffixes like we see in Genesis 1:26. However, a lot of scholarship seems to agree with Dustin as much as it comes to nouns. They would disagree when it comes to pronouns or other forms. And I think the Septuagint is a bit helpful there, because often the translators of the Greek edition of the Old Testament, they would translate plural of majesties by making the reference singular. So instead of, say, for example, the Hebrew word for God is Elohim, that is a grammatical plural, but the referent is singular, which is why it's only translated as God rather than gods. The Septuagint would translate it into the singular Theos, which I think you could probably even see just for the word God in Genesis 1:26.
Yep.
So the word God will be translated by the Greek translators into the singular, but for the pronouns such as let us make man in our image, the plural pronouns have been preserved in the Greek. So it seems that the translators have not understood it as a plural of majesty.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
The late Michael Heiser and also the translators of our very own Revised English Version also thought that that the plural of majesty wasn't what was going on here. They actually agree with the angelic view, which is something that we'll get to. Did you want to discuss the other plural views as well?
Yeah, let's go ahead right through them. Plural of fullness, which you label as probably the standard Trinitarian view.
Yeah.
What's that?
The plural of fullness is the belief that it's presumably God the Father addressing the eternal God the Son and potentially even God the Spirit, but at a minimum it would be the Father addressing the eternal Son. Mm-hmm. I made a brief comment. There's a footnote in the paper where I actually sort of nudge in the ribs this labeling title of the plural of fullness, because you kind of think something's full, it's filled up, but if you've only got part of it, then it's not full. And so it almost implies that if the Father was to create by himself, then it's not full enough. We need the Son and the Spirit as well to assist the Father with creation, which is, I don't know, it almost feels a bit sacrilegious to me to claim that the Father creating by himself is not full enough. But I drew quite extensively from another paper that was written either 1975 or 1985 by Gerard Hazel, which is a German scholar, and he put together a list of different definitions that people have provided throughout history for the use of these plural pronouns in Genesis 1:26. And he obviously favors his view, which is the plural fullness, the Trinitarian version. But it runs into all sorts of problems when you get high-level Trinitarian scholars basically shaking their heads and going, no, don't listen to Hazel, because the ancient author of Genesis would not have understood this in a Trinitarian light. And the NET, which is a really great resource in its full notes edition, actually says it would be anachronistic to read those later ideas in, even though many Christian theologians have attempted to do that. The NET basically says, no, that's not a viable interpretive option.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the Trinity idea comes in, and even the concept of person, not until centuries after Christ. So to posit that it's there in the time of Moses writing Genesis, I mean, it's just, come on.
We're talking millennia.
This is just straight up a classic eisegesis or anachronism, where we're reading things in that are not in its original context. So I agree with you with the NET Bible. Like, it's weird how honest they are. It's refreshing, I should say. It's refreshing how honest they are. So you don't find the plural of fullness very convincing. Or even if you were a Trinitarian, you would say, well, you know, is it really fullness?
Exactly. I mean, you sort of already mentioned it already, but Genesis 1:27, the very next verse, almost does a complete backflip. And all of the words are in the singular now, and it's translated fairly well into English. It says that, so God created man in his own image. His is masculine singular. So masculine singer is used for a single person, but that's actually a different view, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. But verse 27, even if we could overcome the anachronism claim for the plural of fullness, it immediately falters the moment you hit the next verse.
Yeah. Okay, and then next up we've got the plural of deliberation. Talk to us about the plural of deliberation a little bit.
I like the plural of deliberation because this is actually the view that convinced me in the paper when I was writing it. I was convinced that this was the correct view, and I felt that Hazel didn't do a very good job of presenting it in its strongest form. He kind of took like a weak, okay, nearly straw man version of, yeah, it and just knocked that down. And so I thought, what if I took a version of that was based on scripture, it was based on ancient Jewish views and also some rabbinical writings as well, because it is an ancient Jewish view. The plural of deliberation basically teaches that it's just God doing it. It's just God the Father by himself, mm-hmm, creating. But then we kind of need to answer, sure, in verse 27, we can see that it's literally God by himself creating, but that still doesn't overcome the issue of why the plural pronouns used. And so later in the presentation, I say, well, let's try and stick with the Bible to start with. Let's see if there's anything else, any other commentary on the creation account that can help us interpret this. And we bump into Proverbs 8, which talks about the fact that God obviously created by himself. Solomon is not disagreeing with that, mm-hmm, but he's also helping us understand how can God create by himself as one single person and yet also be considered as creating with somebody else, not in a literal sense. And that sense is Lady Wisdom, which is God's personified wisdom. So that's the sort of more developed version of the plural of deliberation that I argue for in the paper.
All right, well, let's come back to that. What about number four here, the mythological address idea? What is that talking about?
Yeah, so the mythological address is something that's more held by hypercritical scholars of the Bible who think that within the Genesis account, there's evidence of Semitic polytheism, essentially, but the continual claim of the Hebrew Bible is actually that there's only one God, Yahweh, and he's the one that's responsible for creating all things. If anything, the Genesis account actually acts as a polemic against belief in multiple gods, belief in a pantheon of gods who were involved with creating. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially a non-starter.
Yeah, and then we have the earthly address idea. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I didn't put too much in my paper about this because this seemed to be defended even less than the plural of wisdom, the plural of deliberation / wisdom view that I was arguing for. But the earthly address is where God is essentially addressing the elements, the dust from which he's creating, and saying, let us make man. But there's not really any scriptural evidence for it. It is an ancient Jewish view.
I think I came across it in the Talmud somewhere.
Yeah, that wouldn't be surprising. It's as early at least as the second century because Justin Martyr thinks it's kind of ridiculous and he tells off Trypho the Jew and says, don't use that argument. I don't like it.
I think it's delightful. You know, like God's like, all right, Earth, you know, let's make humans. And, you know, like when Genesis 2:7 happens, he makes the first man from the dust of the ground. So, you know, I think it's delightful. I would say, additionally to what you said, the added problem is the other texts of the other us texts, like 3:22 and 11:7, which there's no way he's talking to the earth saying, you know, let's go down there and confuse their languages.
Yeah, it breaks the pattern. Yeah.
Right. So I think if we didn't have the other two, and arguably a fourth one in Isaiah 6:8, which I don't think you really addressed in the paper, who will go for us? And he's talking to Isaiah, but yep. It's not Genesis, so I'll give you a pass on that. But
there's a very brief footnote that I put.
Oh, did
in
you?
About
okay,
Isaiah,
good.
So I didn't forget about it.
Right.
But for the sake of time, I just couldn't address it. And there's a lot of angels that are actually present in that Isaiah 6 vision. So I was kind of like, right, throw the dog a bone and just say that's fine. We can say that's the Angels one and just focus on the Genesis account.
Yeah. All right. Now, then we also have the Heavenly Address. Can you explain that?
So the Heavenly Address is sometimes or maybe even often called the Angelic Address. This is super popular in the scholarly literature. This almost seemed like the most favored opinion. It's actually the most favored opinion in my own community as well. It's basically that God announces to the angels his creating intent. You get a sort of split within this address view between people that say that the angels were involved in assisting God literally with creation, and then other people who are saying, no, God is just announcing to the angels his creation intent. But then in verse 27, he just does it by himself, and that's consistent with the rest of scriptural testimony. And in the paper, I actually argue against both views and say that neither of them can really be substantiated in light of the fact that angels are not mentioned as being involved at all. And I also put together a syllogistic argument sort of breaking down how if we say that God is talking to the angels when he says, let us make, but then he is not including the angels when he says our image and our likeness, then we're actually sort of splitting up the verse and interpreting it in two different ways, all within a single sentence. So it doesn't actually work. And we have to read it in light of verse 27 as well, where it's all explained as God doing it by himself, and it's just a singular image. So one person is not going to include a multitude of angels assisting God or humans being made in the image of angels, which is something that is never attested to in the scriptures.
Yeah, and I think you also make a point about the fact that angels are not ever said to have authority. Could you talk about that a little bit and this whole idea of the image of God as being dominion?
Yeah, so that was in a really brief section at the start of, I think it's section 2, where I talk about problematizing the angelic address. In an earlier draft of the paper, I had a much bigger section developing that argument about dominion. And I suppose I can share a bit more info with you here. Essentially, I first came across the view that I did about the plural of deliberation when I was sort of checking to see if there were other options rather than the angelic view. A number of listeners might be familiar with an individual who styled himself as Brother Kel, the Trinity Delusion blog, which is put together by a gentleman named Kel. And he actually talked about the difficulties with the angelic view when he was discussing things in Hebrews chapter 1, because a lot of Trinitarians will draw from Hebrews chapter 1 to build some of their arguments. So I was just working away at my exegesis, making sure that I had everything figured out, that I understood the passage correctly. And I ended up sort of doing a mini study on Hebrews 1 and 2 in and of itself, and following the argument of the writer and seeing these comparative arguments that were being made about how Jesus is better than the angels. The third argument was a little bit weird, because instead of comparing the Son with the angels, in Hebrews 1 verse 10, it actually compares Yahweh, which is the Father, with the angels.
Okay.
So Yahweh is the one that creates everything. That's the work of his hands. But then the angels, God doesn't say to the angels, sit at my right hand, which I'm like, how is that a comparison? And the only way that that comparison then works is that God is the one who has the sole authority over creation, because he's the one who made it. It's the work of his hands. But then angels don't have that authority, because the only conclusion could be that they weren't involved in creation. And then that argument gets developed into chapter 2, because it's all about proving how Jesus is better than the angels. And Jesus is described as the ultimate fulfillment of Psalm 8. That you were mindful of him. So he is actually, in the earliest manuscripts that we have of Hebrews, that man, that representative figure, is given dominion and authority over the work of God's hands. So it's included in the New American Standard 95 edition. But in other translations, people can't think of a reason why later texts would remove that reference about the work of God's hands being given over to humans, so they just don't include it in the text, but it's actually in the earliest text that we have.
Okay, that's interesting. So the point of that is to say that God did not give them dominion, right?
Mm.
And that relates to Genesis 1:26, because if God's talking to the angels, then there has to be a shared dominion or a shared image.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Image means dominion, right?
So yeah, I think image in its first initial instance in Genesis 1:26 is explained by the fact that God says, and let them have dominion over the birds of the air and the fish of the sea and over all the cattle. It's actually explained for us. And I quote from Ian Hart in the paper, because he argues that the Hebrew should actually be translated as, let them be made in our image and likeness so that they have dominion.
I like that. Well, let's further develop the deliberation view, which is the view that you take. And let's come back to Proverbs 8 for a minute. I think an obvious criticism of even just like your title, how Solomon understood Genesis, is that Solomon is so much later than Genesis.
Mm.
And so I can imagine some people thinking, by what right, Sam, can we read Proverbs back into Genesis because it was so much earlier? How would you respond to that line of thinking?
If Christian listeners to your podcast agree with me that Proverbs was written by Solomon, that's probably not the scholarly critical opinion, but that's my presupposition, and that the record of 1 Kings is historically reliable, and that God exists and that he interacts with people who serve him, another presupposition, then we believe that God actually gave Solomon some level of supernatural wisdom and that he was inspired. So it's almost a double whammy that Solomon is both inspired and he has wisdom directly from God to talk about the wisdom that was in the beginning with God. And actually other scholars I mentioned in the paper, they make an argument that Proverbs 8 is actually an inner biblical midrash on the Genesis account, that it's actually directly commenting on Genesis 1. And I do actually also mention there's an argument local to the Genesis account itself, even without Solomon, because, and this is skipping ahead a little bit to Genesis 3, but the serpent says to Eve, if you eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, it's going to be all good. You're not going to die, because the moment that you eat from the tree, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And so Eve interprets that offer by the serpent, that temptation, as being good for food, pleasant to the eyes, and to be desired to make one wise.
Mm.
And there's two other scholars that I quote, draw the conclusion from them that if that is how Eve interpreted the serpent's temptation to her to take the fruit, and the serpent had said, you will be like God, well, one of the scholars commentating on this section in Genesis 3 notices the irony of the serpent's temptation when he says that the serpent was offering something to Eve that she already had. She was already like God. Adam and Eve were made in God's image and likeness. And so Eve interprets that image and likeness as in some sense reflecting God's wisdom. And yet she desired wisdom from taking the fruit of the tree instead, because she was deceived by the serpent that God was holding out on her, that she wasn't made in God's image and likeness.
All right. So what I hear you saying is that there's a native, I don't know what you would call it, wisdom discourse in Genesis already.
I think so, yes, and based on Genesis 3 verse 6.
Solomon comes along and says, okay, well, let's elaborate on that. And
yep.
I don't think it's controversial to say that Proverbs 8 is a midrash on Genesis 1. It seems like a pretty obvious statement. So I don't think there's any reason to push back on that. Your other point that since Proverbs is in the Bible, it's inspired, and therefore it's an authoritative commentary on Genesis 1. I think that pretty much follows for anyone that recognizes the inspiration of Scripture. You've got enough there to work with. I suppose you would have to say that there was some incipient or, you know, just sort of like the beginning stages of a concept of wisdom present in Genesis that was perhaps hidden or just not developed that Proverbs 8 really makes explicit and does develop. Could you just run us through Proverbs 8 a little bit and just like comment on it you know, just in case somebody's not familiar with that text off the top of their head.
Yeah, certainly. Just a very brief point before I do that about what Paul says. So Paul writing in Ephesians in the first century, again, I take the view, and there is scholarship to back it up, that Paul did write Ephesians, Colossians.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Disputed
too.
Letters.
Yeah.
But Paul talks about in Ephesians 3, verse 10, the hidden inner wisdom of God that has now been revealed through the church. There we go. So that through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich variety might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. But right before verse 10, we've got this random mention of, in verse 9, to make everyone see what is the plan of the mystery, so something that was hidden but now it's being revealed, the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. Why do we need to put that in the sentence? It could have just read as the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God, so that through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich variety might now be made known.
Okay.
But instead, we've got dropped right in the middle of that sentence, a reference to God being the creator. And then later in Ephesians, Paul talks about how the church was actually prophesied by Eve, which is Ephesians 5 later in the chapter. So Ephesians 5 verse 31, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. That's quoting Genesis 2 about Adam and Eve. And we're talking about the creation of humanity. That's the topic. And verse 32 says, this is a great mystery. So something that was hidden previously, but now it's been revealed.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm speaking about Christ and the church. So Adam and Eve, in some sense, reflected the relationship between Christ and his church. And we were just told in chapter 3 that the church reveals the inner wisdom of God who created all things. So it seems like Paul is sort of saying that relationship between man and woman reflects some kind of relationship between God and his wisdom, which we read about in Proverbs 8, which is actually the question that you asked me. Mm. So Proverbs 8, for those who are not familiar with it, is a really highly poetic section where Lady Wisdom, which is a personification of God wisdom, not an actual literal person, but a personification. So she's an attribute of God that has been given person-like qualities. And she does all sorts of things. Proverbs 8 verse 1, does not wisdom call and understanding raise her voice?
Mm.
And later in the chapter, we start to have this commentary on the creation account. She talks about how she was there with God in the beginning. So Proverbs 8 verse 22, Yahweh created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old long ago. So I actually take offense at the translation of created. I think that's a distortion that's been made by later Greek translators. The original meaning in Hebrew is, I think the word is kana.
Mm-hmm.
That my pronunciation is probably terrible.
Yeah, it says possess.
Possessed. And that is when it's used of a woman, that is typically used in the context of marriage. And that's particularly used in Ruth. And in some Hebrew traditions, they would actually place Ruth after Proverbs.
Okay.
Which, for those familiar with the descriptions of the worthy man or the worthy woman or the woman of valor or the man of valor, that's something that shows up in both Proverbs and in the book of Ruth. So something worth investigating at another time.
Yeah. I'm just curious what the Septuagint does there. Yeah, so the Septuagint uses the word created, and that's how it probably became common in English.
Yes.
But this is not the typical word for create in Hebrew.
No.
Asa would be the word for create or make.
And this verse in the early Christian. Yeah, that's right. So bara is actually used in Genesis 2 of the creation of Eve. No, sorry, I think bana is used of Eve. But this verse, Proverbs 8 verse 22, became a huge battleground for Christians in the 4th century because the Arians, they wanted to talk about how the Logos, the Son of God, was created. And the pro-Nicenes on the other side, they wanted to say, no, this is not what this means. And then you get people like Athanasius who come along with really weird ideas. And he's like, no, it's all right. It is about creation. It's about the incarnation of the Son. It's like,
In the beginning?
In the beginning?
That
what?
Doesn't make sense.
It's a bit wacky. Yeah, Proverbs 8 is, I think Proverbs 8 verse 22, there's a deliberate use of that word in a poetic sense, kana, because it's talking about God, who is a masculine figure with this feminine figure, and they're creating together. And that's how we get it. Humans in the Genesis 1 account reflecting, somehow they're reflecting two aspects of God, because we've got Adam and Eve, we've got male and female, we've got two figures, but we know from the Hebrew scriptures that Yahweh is only one person. So how do we get two persons from one person? Well, Solomon, I think, provides us with the answer. He gives a poetic discourse in Proverbs 8 about how there was this woman figure, a personification, not a literal lady.
Right.
God's wisdom in the beginning was there with him, assisting him to create. Proverbs 8 verse 31 essentially in some ways gives us on a silver platter that reading, because she says she was there when humans were being created. So then I was beside him like a master worker. This is Lady Wisdom talking. I was daily his delight, playing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the children of man.
Okay.
In light of the rest of the discourse that's happening, where she's talking about how she's there before the foundations of the world are marked out, before when he's drawing the circle of the earth so that the waters don't transgress his command. This is all just before creation is happening. And then boom, when we get the inhabited world, when we get Adam and Eve, she's there when those humans are being created. So we've got somebody there for God to address who's not a literal person. It's his personified wisdom, personified as a woman. And that's how we can have God saying in Genesis 1:26, let us create man in our image and our likeness. And yet in verse 27, you might think, okay, that's a poetic utterance that God says out loud to his personified wisdom. I want to know what that looks like literally. Well, you read the next verse and you see it's just God doing it all by himself. It's just that he does it super wisely. In the paper, I also footnote a lady who's put together all the different lexical links between Genesis 1 to 2 and Proverbs 8, which makes it quite clear that the other scholarly gentleman that I quote, who says that it's an interbiblical midrash, when you look at the tables that she puts together, it becomes quite obvious where she's looking at the exact same Hebrew words appearing in both.
That's an interesting point too. The word for wisdom is chokmah in Hebrew and then Sophia in Greek. And in both cases, they're feminine, which is great because then the personification translates quite nicely between the two languages. That could have been problematic. But since, you know, just by accident of language, those two both identify wisdom as female, that worked out really nicely. But, you know, wisdom is not a female. Wisdom is not a male. Wisdom is a description of actions that go well. Right? Like paying your taxes is wise, because if you don't pay your taxes, the government comes eventually and audits you, and then you get arrested or fined, or, you know, in your life, it doesn't go as well. So we say, oh, paying your taxes is wise. Well, it's just describing something that is good and that works well and that's functional, that's ordered or future thinking. So, you know, wisdom is not a person at all. But in Proverbs 8, wisdom is personified. And what you're saying is that this relates to Genesis 1:26 as God speaking really to himself. Yep. That's what deliberation means. If I say, hey, let's go to the store and buy some clothes, and if I'm the only one in the room, that's me. That's Sean talking to Sean. You know, I am the I and I am the me in that sense. Mm-hmm. So that's the us together is deliberation. And so God's really like having an internal conversation. Hey, let's do this. Let's do that. People who talk to themselves, like me, are quite familiar with this. You know, it's a way of like verbally processing, I guess. Is that pretty much how you see it? Or did you want to add or correct, you know, what I said there?
I think that's a great place to start, but I wouldn't stop there, because that's one of the criticisms that Hazel brings up in his paper on the Let Us reading in Genesis 1:26. He says that this reading, the plural of deliberation, rests on the use of it in the modern languages. I might say, I made pumpkin soup for my wife tonight. because she wasn't feeling super well. So I put in all the spices, and I could have said something like, let us make this soup, but my wife is not going to be helping me because she's sick. I'm cooking it by myself. But is that really going to be enough evidence to say this is what God is doing in Genesis 1:26? I would actually agree with Hazel on its own. That's not enough to build an argument out of, which is why I think it's a good starting place. But we marry that with what we read later in the scriptures, especially in Proverbs 8, to fill out that plural of deliberation with the wisdom aspect. Okay. But you're correct. When we come back to it and we ask, what are we literally talking about here? It's actually just God creating by himself, and he's doing it wisely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One may question how wise it was to create humans, considering all the problems we've caused. But I have faith that in the end, this kingdom is going to come, and that over time, his wisdom will be vindicated in bringing us into this situation. So I would like to transition now to, you know, obviously in the paper, there's a lot more that you discuss and a lot more content that we're not going to be able to get to in this conversation, kind of drawing to the end here. I do have some other questions for you, though. You have this YouTube channel, In His Truth Extended. You've got one video on there. Is this going to happen, or was this just something you started? And it's, you know, tell us about it.
Yeah.
What is your dream?
I put together the first episode in an incredibly busy period because I wanted to make sure it was ready to release at the conference. But I'm in the process of writing scripts for other episodes. Dan Weatherall from Bible Feed was kind enough to leave me a comment on my Biblical Unitarianism episode, the first episode of Correct Christian Teaching, and he said it would be great to hear about some of the arguments in regards to the worship of Jesus and how we're meant to sort of understand what's going on there.
Well, Dan Weatherall is a great guy. We had a lovely walk in the countryside when I was in England last year.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very nice.
Just a real gentleman, and, you know, done so much with technology too. You know,
yeah, he's a real Bible whiz. Feed. I did an episode with him on Bible Feed about the Council of Nicaea, or the Creed of Nicaea, because they were celebrating 1700 years last year. Yeah, 1700 years. Yeah. So we were just doing our best to help uncelebrate Nicaea on that episode. So that's up there. But I'm hoping on my YouTube channel to also put out a vlog on the UCA events that have been happening in Australia. I took some footage of the debate that was held at the Canterbury Christadelphian Ecclesial Hall. Also some of the presentations that happened the day after, and also some footage from the conference that was in Sydney a week later, which I gave my paper at. So I'm hoping that the vlog will go up along with some other videos, but any sort of videos that people think I should produce on there, I'm open to feedback and questions, and I'm hoping to do a few different series on there. So there's stuff coming. It's not just the one episode.
All right. So if people enjoy hearing you and your work, they should subscribe on YouTube to In His Truth Extended, which is just at In His Truth Extended on YouTube.
Yep.
What else is going on in the world of Sam Mansfield? Do you have other projects you're working on, or hopes or dreams for the future?
I'm hoping that the UCA will be something that generates a lot of conversations between particularly people in my community, the Christadelphians, and those who are coming to this understanding of the one God and his son Jesus, and that we can support each other in whatever way is feasible, even if that's just cheering each other on this one aspect of God's truth.
Let me ask you on that. Why do you think it's worth it? Because, I mean, obviously it's inherently risky to work together with other groups outside of your own. Why do you believe in the cause?
Because I believe that truth matters, and truth needs to get out there, and people need to know that bravery and courage to reject what is false in favor of what is truth, no matter the cost, is always going to be more important. I think that's ultimately the reason why.
Yeah. Would you say that we're stronger together?
I think so. I have the benefit of being part of this community that's been ticking away for the past 150 years, and there's been Christians that have held our belief for earlier than that, but as a community, we've been ticking along for 150 years. We can kind of be there as the sort of older big brother to lend other restorationist groups and other individuals a hand to sort of strengthen them rather than let them perish by the wayside. You know, yeah. We're here to offer our advice and what we've learned rather than people hiding in Trinitarian churches and not sharing their truth with the world. They can feel emboldened to share with others and others can come to this understanding. So, yeah, I do think we're stronger together in whatever ways we can work together. And I think that there are a few different ways that we can do that. So we're definitely stronger together than apart.
Let's go back to your earlier remark you were about to make. Who knows? You were about to tell us you're about to drop something big. I can feel it. I'm just kidding. Go ahead. What were you going to say there?
Well, I'm also hoping to explore my paper a little bit more as an episode on the podcast. Sort of a lot of people mentioned at the conference to me that it was a little bit technical, so I want to kind of bring it back down to grassroots, make it really easy for the lay listener. There's also, for people who chew through all of my content on YouTube, there's an audio podcast version as well, which is mainly for people in my community, the Christadelphians, but it's all about searching for truth and reading the Bible and trying to understand it and how that practically affects our lives. I was almost thinking I could go with the slogan like learning what authentic Christianity is and trying to live it out, but I think that was already trademarked by somebody.
Feel free to use it. I don't care. Oh, man. Yeah.
But I have a very similar outlook to you. I want to know what Jesus and the apostles believed. I want to make sure I'm believing the same thing that practically affects our lives, that changes us to be more like Christ while we wait for his coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that people can look at. And the who knows comment was in reference to maybe, God willing, there's some plans that there might be another conference in Australia potentially. And maybe if I write another paper and I really put my back into it, the blind reviewing committee might think it's okay and let me get up and speak again. Who knows?
Who knows? Hey, that would be great. I think you did a great job.
Thank you.
You represented the Christadelphian community well at the event. And we're so excited to have, just speaking as a board member of the UCA, we're so excited to have Christadelphian participation, especially presenting. I appreciate that. Of course, our New Zealand event we had the year previous, we had Dave Burke speak, and I think he's from your neck of the woods. So
He's from Adelaide, just down the road from me. Yeah.
And so that was great to have him as well. So anything else you'd like to say before we close out here?
I just wanted to say thanks so much for having me on the Restitutio podcast. I really appreciate your whole ethos and your approach to the scriptures. I find very, very little to disagree with. I really encourage people to check out your work if this is the first episode that they're hearing of Restitutio. Always keep searching for truth. If you find that a theology that you hold in your life is sort of grating up against some scriptures that you've been reading, investigate it, check it out, have an open mind and really search for truth. And I think it's actually Proverbs that also says that, you know, find truth and wear it like a garland, a necklace around your neck. I think that's a really beautiful image. And I think that's what we should be doing as Christians. We should be searching out God's truth and learning to live in it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it.
Well, that brings our conversation to an end. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 655, God Spoke to Himself in Genesis 1:26, and leave your questions and thoughts there. On our previous episode, 654, The Plight of a Restorationist with Matt Lovegrove, Haas wrote in saying, "Thank you for presenting this. Churchianity is quite an excrement expo. I can relate to what Matt has to say." Well, that is certainly one way of putting it, Haas. Thanks for writing in. The problem with church, and you're talking, and I'm talking as somebody who's been involved in church leadership in various capacities for 21 years, is that it's full of people. And whether we're talking about the leaders or the just regular attenders, we're all people. We all have flaws and blind spots, and sometimes we are too forceful, and many times we are not confrontational enough, and sometimes we hold to one principle when we should really hold to another principle. And there are these tensions between truth and love, honesty and compassion, and it is hard to get it right. Now, having said that, I don't want to excuse the incredibly poor treatment of Matt by the various churches that he has attended for non-sinful, non-excommunicable offenses. The fact is that churches need to allow space for people to believe different things so long as that person is not disrupting the faith of others. Ideally, churches would also allow space for debate or discussion and honest inquiry, which is nowhere in Matt's story. Go ahead and listen to it last week if you aren't sure what I'm talking about. On that same episode, Lloyd Scott writes in saying, maybe in a neutral setting, but the adversary is the god of this cosmos and not in a neutral playing field, for it is tilted against. So if Yah does not save me, then will not be saved. All right, just to give a little context here for Lloyd's comment, and of course, Lloyd, you'd have to correct me if I get you wrong here, but that was a bit condensed and a bit esoteric. But what I think he's talking about is Matt's change of heart with respect to monergism, the idea that God alone saves and that someone does not actually have faith or participate in his or her salvation whatsoever. And what Lloyd is saying is that our world is so fallen, so not neutral, that we have no ability whatsoever to choose God. And this is precisely the idea that Matt's dad, if you remember the interview last week, Matt's dad has ceased to believe in, that got him kicked out of a church that he even started and preached the first sermon in. It's incredible to get kicked out of your own church. But there is a small club of these noble people that have the guts to continue learning and continue seeking truth, even though other people are really uncomfortable with that. Anyhow, the text that got Matt's dad's attention was the one in Romans 4, which is a repetition of the one in Genesis 16, I believe, or maybe is it 15:6, where it says Abraham believed and God credited it to him as righteousness. And the point was, well, the Bible says Abraham believed, ergo Abraham believed. So to use some sort of slick move and say, well, that belief that Abraham had really came from God, it was a gift from God, that is a sleight of hand. I'm sorry. Like, we have no hope if we are forced to interpret the Bible in such a strange and non-face value way when such plain statements occur and then get repeated in the New Testament as the basis for the whole system that everyone bases monergism on. Romans 4, Romans 3, 4, and 5 is, you know, a go-to section to talk about justification by faith, right? So I don't think monergism stands. I'm a synergist, proud to be one. I think we do work together with God. God is seeking those who want him, and those who choose him, he saves. The metaphor I use to think about this is that we are stuck in the quicksand, and we cannot get out on our own. The harder we fight, the deeper we sink. But we can do one thing, which is reach our hands up. We can reach our hands up, and God can reach his hand down and then pull us out. And I don't think, having experienced deliverance in such a fashion, we should say, oh, well, look what we did. No, all we did was reach up in faith. God reached down in grace and pulled us out. God saved us, but we did have participation in the process. God is not saving everyone. God wishes everyone would be saved, but not everyone repents. That's fascinating, isn't it? It's almost as if God honors our free will or something. Stay Young, my friends, wrote in also on this episode saying, this is a great validation of the work the UCA is doing. I totally hear Matt grappling with the fear that you are alone on questioning the Trinity doctrine. The internet has been a major blessing for Christian truth seekers around the world. Paul writes in, "You are my people. I resonate with so much of this." I also wanted to let you know that we are planning to have a UCA conference in October. That would be October 22nd to the 24th in Tempe, Arizona. It's going to be hosted at Lakeshore Bible Church, and this is going to be a time for a lot of people to gather, especially those who are West Coast or anyone really who can fly in and be part of it. But these conferences are a great time to learn a lot about scholarship in the field of biblical Unitarianism. And if you are somebody in the U.S. that has been listening to this podcast and would like to meet others, this is really a great rallying point for all of us to get together. We'll have a number of presentations. I'm planning to be there, and hopefully I'll be able to have my wife, Ruth, with me, as she has been coming with me in recent years. And we would love to meet you. So if you are in the U.S. or Canada, Mexico, somewhere within reasonable travel time of Arizona, hey, put it on your calendars, October 22nd to the 24th. Registration is not yet up. Also, if you are someone who has something to say, if you are somebody who would like to present a topic at the UCA conference, I know that there are slots available for people to present. The system that we have set up for this event is that people submit a paper, and then there is a blind review process. So you don't have to be part of the inside group or anything like that. It is totally blind. The people who are doing the paper review don't know who the submitters are, and those who are submitting don't know who the reviewers are. And they rate the papers based on merit, and then those are some of the folks who get to present at the conference. So if you have an idea brewing, do the research now. I mean, it's June, so the deadline for this is probably going to be August, if I had to guess. And I'm sure we'll see more information on the Unitarian Christian Alliance website for this. That's unitarianchristianalliance.org. And it would be great to meet any of you at that event in October. Well, that's going to be it for today. Thanks, everybody, for listening here to the end. If you'd like to support Restitutio, the number one way you can do that is to share this episode with your friends. It's absolutely free, and it is the number one way that people hear about the show is through word of mouth. Also, if you'd like to support us financially, that's a huge help. Thanks to all of you who are doing that, especially on a monthly recurring basis. You can do that at restitutio.org, O-R-G, and there's a donate button there. I'll catch you next week, and remember, the truth has nothing to fear.